We made this.
Back everybody to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for this episode, which is all about the third episode of season 8, which is Patience. And I'm delighted to be joined for this episode by Christopher Pilbeam. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, Carl. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's nice to talk to you. We haven't spoke before. You have been on the X-Cast, haven't you? But this is your first outing, I guess, on the main episode, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I think we'll have a bit of fun with this one. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think of it, what you think of season 8 and things like that. Before we come to this episode specifically, though, like I said, you've been on the X-Cast, but it's always been on... What episodes have you been on? It was a roundtable, I remember hearing you on.
Yeah. I did a roundtable with Luke and Russ last year. And that's it. Yeah.
Until today. So... The traditional rite of passage is to answer the 5 questions of X for people who first come on the main episode. So you said to me, Christopher, that you've been thinking about these for a while. Is that right?
Yeah, basically since I first started listening to the X-Cast, I've been planning my answers. So the day has finally arrived.
So you haven't had any last minute kind of changes of heart or anything like that?
There's one question that I my answer will change based on the day. I'll tell you that when we come to it.
Okay. So I'm interested to hear this because I think there's one question I definitely know or suspect what your answer will be.
I wonder which one that could be.
Yeah, well, we'll see. And the others I'm not sure about. So to kick us off then, when did you first discover the X-Files? Nice, simple question.
So I discovered the X, or rather I had the X-Files discovered for me. Like late 2017 or early 2018, I just turned 15 and my dad introduced me to it because he was a fan of the show and he watched it in the 90s. We always watched like Star Trek and stuff together when I was younger. So it seemed like he was quite excited to introduce me to it. We watched the pilot and then we carried on from there. And I, according to him, my only reaction about the pilot was to say, and this is a direct quote, that it was cool. So clearly very enthusiastic right off the bat, but yeah.
So did you see things like season 11 after the fact, or did you see them at the time?
I was just too late, I think, to catch the revival as it was coming out. I remember seeing like posters for it and going like, oh, I know that show, but no, I was too late. So I watched season 11 after it aired.
Do you feel like coming to the series at a later date than most of the fan base gives you kind of a different perspective on things? Because I guess you wouldn't have known going in a lot of the time about, you know, what the classic episodes are and things like that. You just kind of discovered it as you went along. Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah. And for like the longest time, I didn't know anyone who watched The X-Files because from what I hear, like when it was airing, it was, you know, hugely popular. And so you could talk about it with the other people who were watching it. I basically just had my dad until I was in maybe like when I'd got to season 5 and I finally discovered that there were people online who liked the show too. I didn't have this. The one thing that really gets me is I didn't get any of the shipper hype. Because, you know, I never had someone sitting next to me going, oh, I hope Mulder and Scully get together. So upon discovering that people wanted to get them to get together, I was like, wait, what? Okay. Sure.
Okay, so the second question is, what is your favourite episode?
So this episode has been my favourite episode since I first watched the episode. And I'm way too stubborn to change it now. And it's Pusher, which I feel like is in most people's top 10. So I don't need to explain in great detail why I love it. But it's just like, it's like the most intense scene you've ever seen on television, and that happens like three times in one episode. And it's just, I think it's fantastic. And I tend not to rewatch it very often because I don't want to like, I don't want it to lose its potency, if that makes sense. But yeah. That's my favorite episode.
Yeah, no, I think that definitely makes sense. I can think of, you know, some episodes that I feel the same way about, almost as if you'll diminish them by repetition or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great choice. You can't really go wrong with Pusher. So what about the sequel then? Kitsunagari, how do you feel about that?
I feel like that there didn't necessarily need to be a sequel, but for what it is, I quite enjoyed it. I think that it still managed to be quite intense and quite scary. And so it was enjoyable. I don't think it needed to exist, but it didn't like ruin Pusher.
Yeah. Yeah. Worthwhile as far as it goes, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So Pusher from the third season. Now, we recently did a round table about ranking the seasons, and everybody on there had season three right at the top, or second place, I think somebody had. What about you, Christopher? What is your favourite season? Is it the third season?
It's not the third season. My favourite season, I would say, is season six. Because it has, first of all, it has like a high percentage of banger episodes. Like,
yeah.
like a season that has Triangle and Milagro and Arcadia and SNR-19. Like, I just can't, it can't not be my favourite. And also, I kind of feel like people judge it too quickly, and I sympathize with that. Like, it's not a cool kid season like three or four. It's a bit of an underdog season, which I kind of like. I would say season six.
When you say not a cool kid season, do you mean because it kind of shifts to a bit of a lighter approach with a lot of episodes? And
it's more that it gets a lot of shtick from fans because of that. You know, people who are like hardcore season 1 to 5, I feel good about not being part of that group.
In fact, we were talking about this offline, weren't we?
Yeah.
A week or two ago, about the term X-Files light and how it can be used kind of pejoratively, can't it? That's the sort of thing you mean, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a bit smug about the fact that I haven't judged season six for being light, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, kind of like judge it for what it is rather than what it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that it will be relevant to Patience as well. It's all coming together.
Ah, interesting. Well, we'll return to that. Okay, the next question is the one that I suspect I know the answer to. So just based on your online postings and things like that. So who is your favourite character? So this could be Mulder, it could be Scully, it could be a recurring character that's not one of those two. It could be a one-off guest star or somebody, you know, who are you going for?
Give me a moment to pretend to think about this. No, I think my love of this character is very, very well documented. My favourite character of the X-Files is Alex Krycek. And okay, I have a prepared statement because I was like, I can't go on about this for too long. So basically, the reason why is that people say that Mulder is a bit of an outsider and that they relate to him because of that. But I think that Krycek is like the ultimate outsider because he's not part of the FBI gang and he's never really a part of the syndicate either. And he's in conflict with every single authority figure, which I respect. And he sabotages the smoking man at every opportunity. And he exposes people like Matheson and, yes, Skinner, for their hypocrisies. I think he wanted to be a hero like Mulder, but he never had the luxury. And once he was branded as the bad guy, that was it for him. I don't think he's a good person. But I do think there's more to him than people realise. Plus, I like not having the same favourite character as everyone else.
And do you think, have you found other Krycek fans? Is this a... relatively niche fan base?
I think that from what I've seen, he definitely had a following in the 90s, judging by like the sheer amount of like fan fiction archives that there were dedicated to him. But basically, I still have it. I just didn't use it anymore. An Instagram account where I was like going through and analysing all of Krycek's scenes. So, yeah, and that sort of attracted people who were like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that anyone else appreciated Krychek in this way, or oh my goodness, I haven't thought about Krychek like this for years, or whatever. So that was quite nice to kind of so yeah, there's there's a few of us.
So do you feel like we got enough Krychek? Because that's always been a subject of discussion, hasn't it, in the sense that he never got like a Krychek centered episode in the way that the Lone Gunman did, or Skinner,
and,
or whoever.
Right, and supposedly there was meant to be one, but there couldn't be because of Nick Lee's schedule. And you know what? I'm secretly quite glad about that, because I'm not a huge fan of, like, of say, like, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man, and I'm not a huge fan of the Lone Gunman one.
Yeah.
And so I just, like, I feel like the mystery is really important to why I like the character. And I wouldn't have wanted them to be like, here's a tragic backstory, here's exactly why he is the way that he is. I think that I know exactly as much about him as I need to. So I think, yeah, we got enough Krychek.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that, you know, that kind of thing definitely could have become a bit too literal, couldn't it? And spelled things out we don't really need to know. I would rather have seen a Krychek episode rather than like a multiple Lone Gunman episodes, I've got to be honest. But yeah,
that's true. You know, I would have, having said that, I wouldn't have liked a backstory episode, but if he could have been in like a Monster of the Week, I know he was in Sleepless, which is a Monster of the Week, but say like later down the line, just like a one-off, like Krychek and Marita investigate a spook, that would have been cool.
Okay, so we'll move on to the final question, which is what is your favorite moment from the series? And it can be as big or as small as you like. It can be with Krychek or without Krychek. Is it to you?
This is my big debate, isn't it? Do I pick one and then it's predictable, or do I not pick one and then I'm betraying him? It's like, oh my goodness, this is the one that I said I find really hard because it changes all the time. I mean, we've spoken about this offline. It's such like a multifaceted show that how do you possibly pick a moment that represents all of them? But I've decided upon reflection that since my favourite episode doesn't have Krychek in it, that my favourite moment should. So I've gone with, oh, and it's in my favourite season, so it's great. This is in One Sun, and it's when Krychek is like storming out of Fort Marlene after he's seen the LMI flask has been stolen, and then Jeff Spender goes, hey, Krychek, over here. And he looks around the door and he sees what has become of Marita Covarrubias. And it's just like the 2 second shot of the look on his face. I just love it. It's just, it's for about 2 seconds, his face is like completely absent of humor or bravado. And he's just like shocked. And I think that like Nick Lee deserves a lot of credit for having like these, but injecting throughout the series like these small moments of humanity, and I just think it's great. I remember seeing that and like I was like, oh my god, that's so sad.
That's a fascinating one, and I'm pretty sure no one else has ever picked that moment, which is great. You know, Krychek and Marita, then, are you kind of sad? Because obviously one of the things of season 8 was Marita doesn't appear, Krychek appears a few times. There's some talk, I don't know, I'm assuming you've heard that, like off-screen talk, that maybe they were going to be kind of the adversaries, those two together, but they couldn't work out because Laurie Holden was busy and that sort of thing. That could have been fascinating, couldn't it, to have those two play a much more prominent role in the latter part of the series, you know?
It would have been. I just, like, I didn't like them together to begin with. Like, I was not a fan. In, like, Patient X, I was not on board with that. But you know what? It grew on me. By the time we got to Requiem, I was like, this is cool. It's like, I don't know, because you so rarely see Krychek actually working with someone. So that was cool. And I do think that that would have been nice. And like, I heard something about there was a spin-off that never got made. And like, yeah, I think that, I do think it's a shame that there was not more of those two. But again, it's like, I don't want to say that, because if we had gotten more of them, it might have been terrible.
And things can get kind of blunted by repetition, can't they? Like,
yes,
the Smoking Man's a good example of that, I think, where the Smoking Man works really well in the early seasons and then in the later seasons is he's nowhere near as effective. Do you know what I mean?
And like, and my fear would be that they would just end up being like Mulder and Scully, and that it would end up being too much about their like romantic relationship or sexual relationship or lack thereof, and not enough about what actually makes them interesting. So yeah, it's kind of just have to, well, what we got was good, and just kind of have to work with that.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy outlook, certainly at this stage. Now there are no more X-Files coming, for sure. It seems like. All right, let's move it on. It was great to hear those answers, so thank you for that.
No, you're welcome.
What about season 8 in general before we move on to Patience specifically? Because we've been talking about this on the X-Cast, obviously, with these, you know, with the early episodes of season 8 and the fact that opinion is kind of all over the place on it. Where do you stand? Like, I suppose some people really don't like this series. Some people don't like the series after Mulder is not full-time anymore. Other people think it's a bit of a tonic and it rejuvenates things. What are your thoughts generally?
I love season 8. I would even go as far as to say the first half before Mulder comes back is maybe better than the second half. Listen, I love Mulder. I do. And David Duchovny is nice to look at. But the X-Files has other strengths. I think that I found season 7 to be a bit of a drag. And like, season 7 had consistently great mythology, like Closure and Requiem were great, but the Monster of the Weeks were usually mediocre to crap. Season 8 has like fantastic Monster of the Weeks, and it's kind of the mythology that lets it down a little bit. You can imagine I have strong feelings of resentment towards the season finale, which does sort of bring the whole season down a little bit. But like, other than that, I think it's nice. I think it's really good. I like that it's a bit more millenniumistic. It's a bit more Vancouver-esque, which I just like to point out proves that it wasn't the city of Vancouver itself that made the tone, because this wasn't shot in Vancouver. I think that I enjoy Doggett and Scully's dynamic. So yeah, I thought I was going to hate it. I thought, I was like, how could I possibly watch the X-Files and not see Mulder's face all the time? Turns out it's actually quite easy, and it was very good.
Did you know by the time you got to season 8 that Mulder was going to be in a relatively limited number of episodes? Did you have full knowledge?
By then I knew. It was like, it got harder and harder to avoid spoilers, and I knew that that David Duchovny had stepped back. So yeah, I was anticipating it. I ended up being quite pleasantly surprised.
To be honest, I feel much the same way as you do. I think it's a better season than season 7, and I think that everything up to, not everything, but the episodes up to Mulder's return at the end of This Is Not Happening, I find that chunk of the season more rewarding than what comes later. I think quite often, you're right, I think the absence of Mulder is fascinating, isn't it? Because it generates some interesting kind of wrinkles for them to explore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when that's foregrounded, I think it works really well. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's almost like, I don't want to go on about this, but like, they don't, with Mulder's not there, without Mulder, you can't have MSR. And perhaps something that I didn't like about season 7 was how much even the Monsters of the Week had to focus on Mulder and Scully's romantic relationship. And it was just a bit like a relief that it wasn't going to be about that anymore. And you know, once Mulder comes back, it's about Mulder being back, you know. I still like the second half of the season until the end. And I also think, like, this has been said, but it's sort of refreshing, because obviously after Closure, it was like, well, what on earth is the direction of the show now? Because Mulder is no longer looking for Samantha. Well, good news, now Scully is looking for Mulder. So it's like that whole, like thematic spine of the series kind of gets an update.
Which is very relevant, of course, to this episode, to Patience, isn't it?
Yes.
So we'll move on to that now, I think. And just, a few general thoughts and a mark out of 10, if you don't mind. And then I'll give mine after you've had your say.
So general thoughts is I think that it's a very good, like, I would compare it to maybe like Detour Quagmire kind of, it's a promise of the premise kind of episode. Two FBI agents go hunting for a monster. I think that there are like a few flaws that we'll get to. I think that, you know, and I rewatched it quite a few times in order to research for this podcast, and it doesn't, like, it's not like one that you can rewatch loads of times and still think, oh, this is an amazing episode, because, you know, it's good, but it's not, you know, I don't know, it's not via negativa, you know. And so my mark out of 10 would be 6.5, and bearing in mind I rank from 0 to 10, so like, yeah, that 6.5 is, yeah, 6.5 is like upper mid, a little bit better than average.
Yeah, you know what, we're not far off actually. I'm at about a 7, and the thing is that, and I think what you're saying is very true, because I don't like this episode as much as I once did. I remember really liking it back in the day when it first broadcast. Oh, I forgot to say, yeah, first broadcast in November 2000. The episode is written and directed by Chris Carter. And of course, we're talking about the episode in which Scully and Doggett investigate the killings that appear to be the work of a bat-like creature. I remember being really taken with it back in 2000. And I think when you rewatch, you realize how some aspects of it don't really click how they should, do they?
Yeah.
I still admire it, though, in certain respects. And I still think in a lot of ways, it's a very necessary episode. One of the things I admire, so I think there are some really big strengths. One of the things I admire is that it's consciously this back to basics standalone, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're very far here from the lighter tone that's characterized much of the previous two seasons. And I agree with what you were saying earlier in, you know, I don't think people should dismiss 6 and 7 out of hand, but this is definitely a shift back to what the series came to be known for, isn't it? And of course, with the proviso that, yeah, in 6 and 7, you have some dark episodes too, but there is a shift in 6 and 7, I think. This feels like something that could slot into one of those very early seasons. It's reminiscent of things to me like Squeeze and Shapes in certain ways. But the thing is, there's a positive and a negative to that. So if it's back to basics, I think sometimes how basic it is becomes a bit of a problem. Like, it's quite repetitive, it's quite straightforward in ways that I don't think are always helpful. That does have a good side, because it means there's a lot of scope here and a lot of space to explore these character dynamics between Doggett and Scully, isn't there? And I think that works well, and that's a strong suit of the episode for me. I just wish it could have been married to a stronger case in some ways. Like, I think the next episode, Roadrunners, is a good example of a really strong first-rate X-File combined with a really interesting look at this new setup with the characters. And I don't think Patience quite does that, does it? And
no, I agree.
But I think the pluses outweigh the negatives. So yeah, a good episode for me overall, I would say, if that makes sense.
Yes, I agree that, like, obviously the most interesting part about this episode is Scully working with Doggett, and that there's just something that could have been tweaked a little bit to make the case more interesting was, like, the reason why this man bat thing was hunted to begin with, because it seems to me that it's an episode about overcoming prejudice and assumption as Doggett kind of enters the world of open-mindedness. And it's like, I don't know, it's sort of vaguely alluded to in the episode, maybe the man bat thing was hunted in as revenge, but then I looked in the X-Files archives thing, and apparently it just says in there that it was shot during a routine deer hunt. And it's like, if there had been an element where perhaps the man bat had been hunted and killed because these townspeople were prejudiced against something that wasn't quite human, and that could have been like an added element to the episode. Also, this was written and directed by Chris Carter. I think it's his only directing credit this season.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Which reminds me of Triangle, which is another Chris Carter thing, which came right at the beginning of season 6, which was another point in the show where they had experienced upheaval. And it was like Chris Carter wanted to take the reins almost to like set an example. And now that, you know, now that it's no longer Mulder and Scully, it's Scully and Doggett, maybe he wanted to set an example to the rest of the crew going forward. Like, this is how you make a Scully and Doggett episode. Also, it's interesting that he would write an episode about prejudice and assumption, as if he's saying to the audience not to judge the new season before it's even started.
That is fascinating, yeah. And in terms of it being an episode directed by him, it's a big, like you say, it's got that parallel with something like Triangle in terms of, okay, here's how we can do stuff in LA. And here it's, here's how we can do stuff with this new character pairing. But it's quite a big shift from the episodes he had been directing, isn't it? Because he, so you have things like Triangle, How to Ghost Stole Christmas, Postmodern Prometheus. This is much more stripped down, isn't it? And it's been quite a long time since we've seen him direct an episode like that. I can't really remember. Something like The List, probably. You probably have to go back that far, don't you, to get something that's a relatively straightforward standalone from him, directed by him.
It does kind of like give the sense that he's playing it safe. Like maybe he's not sure how this new character is going to fit in. But yeah, maybe it was deliberate.
I'm interested in what you're saying about the bat creature as well, because I was watching it again and I was thinking, I don't really understand this. I don't really understand how this guy, Ernie Stefaniak, so the implication is that he's kind of obsessed with bats. Is that right? Have I missed that?
This thing about him collecting bats and taxiderming them, I'm like, the only thing I could think of is maybe he's experimenting on ways to kill them.
Yeah.
Like, because he wants to hunt the man bat, so he's like trying to figure out how, like, a bat's weakness or something. There's like this thing about like fear turning into obsession. I'm like, this guy's like one dead parent away from becoming Batman. Like, it's this, yeah. There are some parts of it that are not super clear.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree. I'm glad it's not just me. Have you had a look, Christopher, on IMDb? Have you seen what the rating is? If not, do you want to have a guess?
No, I haven't. I'll have a guess. I seem to remember that that season 8, I seem to remember it ranks mostly in the 8s, like 8 point something. Okay, this may be way too high, but I'm going to guess 8.0.
It's a bit too high. I wouldn't say way too high. It actually has 7.5 out of 10.
Cool.
So it's actually one of the lower episodes for the whole season. It's like at the time of recording, it's 16th for the season when you line them all up, which seems a bit low to me, I think, because I actually do have a sneaking fondness for this, even if it's not quite as good as I once thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, that seems low, but and it would be low if this episode was in season 7, but then like there were a lot of really good episodes in season 8, so that maybe that's fair enough.
Yeah, you are right though. It seems like most episodes are in the 8s and above, you know, 8.0 upwards for season 8, which is quite interesting. All right, then I think we should take a closer look at Patience. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay, so we get a dark, moody teaser, don't we? We're in Idaho. It's, you know, obviously the Undertaker returning home before being attacked by the creature, and his wife subsequently is attacked too. So what are your thoughts? I think it's a pretty uncomplicated teaser in a lot of ways, isn't it? Like, it's pretty clear from the outset that, okay, this is an episode about a creature that looks a lot like a bat that's eating people. That's kind of what we're in for.
And I know you said that it was dark and moody, but at the same time, it's like a little bit camp because there's like the lightning flashes and the glowing red eyes on the weather vane, and like the shot of the guy standing in the doorway with his trousers around his ankles. I'm like, I almost feel like you could put this cold open at the beginning of a comedy episode and that would still make sense. So it's a bit of a weird one, but yeah, you're right. There's nothing particularly mysterious about this other than, I guess, what the specific nature of the monster is.
And what's motivating it, maybe, I suppose, you know. That's interesting, yeah. So what, you could see this Undertaker in an episode like Bad Blood in that sort of community, is that the kind of thing you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a little bit like it's just comedic. I'm just like, this poor guy's about to be mauled to death and you can see like his garters. Well.
And his last words, you know, or some of his last words are this discussion about the smell of embalming fluid. Okay, so just before we get to after the credits, I think it's noteworthy that the first episode, I believe, that where David Duchovny does not receive a credit in the opening. So he does appear, doesn't he? Because there's the image in the credits of him falling, of Mulder falling. But yeah, no, we're definitely in a new era, aren't we? So, yeah.
Although, is that Mulder, though? Or is that the alien bounty hunter pretending to be Mulder when he falls off the cliff?
Oh, is it from is it? Without? Is
yeah, it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's... And it's definitely David Duchovny, but I'm not sure that it's Mulder, although I didn't fact check that. But yes, I did... I'm not going to lie, sometimes I skip the intro on season 8 episodes because I don't particularly like them, although I like them more than I like the ones on season 9. So there's
agreed.
That.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I'm a bit too old school to skip intros. So, you know, I'd feel like I was cheating on Mark Snow or something. Do you know
what I mean? Yeah, that's fair enough.
Okay, so I think some interesting stuff at the outset of this episode. So the FBI office, with Scully looking at Mulder's nameplate as Doggett enters, and he's just been, it seems like, laughing and joking with a couple of the guys. And we sort of hear a few snippets of what they say, don't we? But don't hear what Doggett had to say, but he appears to have been laughing along with it, doesn't he?
Right.
How do you take that?
Yeah, so it's like he's surrounded by these dude bros that sort of remind me of the guy in Squeeze, you know, like Scully's old friend from the academy or whatever. Yeah. I think that's very clearly like setting up for what will become a theme of like the male dominated crime scene that they arrive to quite soon after. And also I think that we're supposed to do what Scully is doing, which is assuming the worst of Doggett. And obviously like he kind of in some small ways he proves himself over the course of the episode, but we're supposed to think that he's not a nice guy because that's how Scully's seeing him.
And we get an immediate indication of maybe not proving himself, but an indication that there's more to him than that when he says, well, I've been here all weekend. I've read every X-File in the cabinet, you know, and I think that recurs with him, doesn't it? He's someone who puts in the legwork,
yeah,
which I've always liked about his character. Yeah.
Bless him. He's definitely hardworking.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that scene, that moment where we hear the other guys and they come in, it does begin that tendency, which comes through the whole episode, I think, or a lot of it, about keeping Scully on the other side of things, you know, on the outside of things, which works really well. I think the emphasis on Scully is actually quite clever, because it would have been quite easy, wouldn't it, to do an episode like this and make it much more about Doggett. And that's not what Carter chose to do. And I quite like that, actually. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think that it's about Scully having to accept a new partner, because she does things like, she calls it her partner's office, not Mulder's office, as if like it's actually difficult for her to say his name. And then the whole thing about the nameplate as well. And it's like, it's difficult for her. And because like, if she accepts Doggett as her partner, that's like admitting that Mulder's not coming back. So it's that kind of resistance that she has. I just like, it's like they make a point of the nameplate, and I will have a point at this at the end because it comes back at the end of the episode. But like for now, the thing that gets me about this office and Mulder not being there isn't the nameplate. It's not even the slideshows. It's when you see his basketball on the shelf in the corner. I'm just like, that's so sad. Who's going to play basketball in the office now?
Well, Scully has to embody what Mulder used to do in some ways, in the sense that she gives a slideshow. So maybe she's been like also shooting a few hoops. I think she gives a slideshow is interesting. It's like something that happens quite a bit towards the start of this episode is some of these elements that have become routine and standardized in the earlier seasons, they feel very different here, don't they? Because of the absence of Mulder. So like Scully gives the presentation, but I don't know how you felt. And I think it's really well acted by Gillian Anderson, but something just feels a bit wrong about it, or definitely less natural than it was when Mulder would like lay these things out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's so like stilted between them. It's like when she asks if he has any questions, it's almost like she doesn't want him to have any questions. And like no one's making any jokes about what's on the slides, and that's something that Mulder would do, even though it's, you know, death and blood and stuff. Doggett takes everything very seriously, maybe as he should, but that's quite noticeable. Like, yeah, it's just thinking of like the iconic slideshow scenes, like you getting like Bad Blood and stuff. It's just so awkward because Scully obviously doesn't want Doggett to be there, but Doggett's just like, I'm so focused and I'm going to work hard on this case. poor guy.
Poor guy, yeah. Okay, and then so they go out to Idaho, of course, and meet the local law enforcement. And again, kind of what I was saying, that like this is the kind of scene that we've seen many, many iterations of over the past 7 seasons. But now suddenly it feels quite different because of the way the roles have shifted around, doesn't it? So it's quite a lengthy sequence is the first thing I noticed. Because quite often by this point in the series, or, you know, by 6 and 7, investigating the opening crime scene is something that's done quite perfunctorily, it seems like, and then you're off onto other things.
Yeah.
And here it's quite an extended sequence. Or it felt like that way to me anyway. I don't know about you.
No, I think that that's a very apt observation. It's like they're clearly like pointing us towards the fact that the point of the episode is the dynamics between the investigators rather than the actual investigation. I think that this is like, it's like Mulder throughout his whole career faced prejudice and bias from people. He would be knocking heads with people constantly, and now Scully is suddenly facing that same thing, but it's like extra spicy because there's misogyny involved as well. And it's like, yeah, this Yale Abbott guy, oh man, if anyone deserved to get bit by that man, that thing, right? It's his body language. It's the way that he steps between Scully and Doggett to talk to Doggett.
Yeah, well, like you say, he gets his comeuppance in good time, I suppose. You're right. I think it's never clearly articulated, is it? But it's that aspect of it all feels very gendered, which is quite fascinating. So the fact that they're all male cops is obviously notable.
Yeah.
Like you say, this character, this detective, because he is quite aggressive to Doggett too, but it's something very pointed about the way he turns away from Scully, doesn't he, and addresses his remarks directly to Doggett at various points, actually. I quite like that Carter leaves it. He doesn't kind of put too much of a fine point on it, I suppose. I think the actions speak loud enough, don't they?
Yeah, I think that it's a much more like subtle and effective. Obviously, I can't necessarily speak to this because I'm a man, but from my perspective, at least, it seems like a much better handling of sexism in the workplace than, say, they tried to do in like First Person Shooter, which just completely failed. And I like that, you know, being as how this episode is about assumption. I think Scully even says, I'd say that assumption is the problem here. And it's like, oh boy, thematic marker. Given that is the theme of the episode, as to how it relates to Doggett working for the X-Files for the first time and having to let go of his assumptions, how this theme is sort of externalized in the sexism of the workplace. I think that that's quite clever, and it's again this thing I was talking about earlier. If they had managed to tie in that theme to the actual case, then it maybe would have felt a bit stronger.
Which I think is something that happens in Roadrunners, for example. I think the themes run through the case as well as through what Scully does there. So this episode isn't quite as effective in that regard. What I do like about some of this stuff with the local cops and things is it kind of brings back the influence of the Silence of the Lambs on the X-Files, I think. Because I think that film, I don't know if you've seen it, but Clarice Starling in that film gets similar treatment at times from local law enforcement. And obviously she was an influence on Scully, and it really resonates through this episode to me. I don't know if that occurred to you or anything like that, you know.
That's a good point. And of course it is a Chris Carter episode, and he is a fan of Silence of the Lambs, so that does make sense. I just think it's so admirable how Scully keeps her cool in front of these people.
Well, I think she's had a long history of dealing with it. I think one episode that springs to mind for me, is it Too Shy, early season 3 episode anyway, where there's an overtly sexist local detective. You know,
right,
in fact, even more overtly sexist than these guys are, because in that episode he was like, you know, explicit about it not being a woman's shouldn't be a woman's job and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So she's accustomed to it, unfortunately, I think. I think it's all very appropriate. I actually really like this crime scene sequence more than a lot of the rest of the episode, to be honest. I feel like it's all very appropriate for an episode where we're getting acquainted to what this show now is and what a standalone episode now is in particular, you know. It all feels fresh again, and also strangely familiar, which I like. One aspect I'm less fond of are some of the attacks, you know, that this creature does. So I think, is it Mrs. McKesson we see attacked after this? So I don't know. Is it just me? Some of this feels a bit more like marking time. You know, it's like we've got to get through there's going to be a series of attacks until we get to the end of the episode. And it all feels a bit kind of humdrum to me.
Which is interesting because I sometimes feel like they're giving too much screen time to things that I don't really care about and not enough to things that would actually be more interesting. I think that this happens a lot towards the end with like Ernie and Myron as well. Like, I think I see way too much of them. I agree. There's nothing like, it's not like an episode like Pusher where you want to see all of Pusher's attacks because they're particularly scary and creative. It's just the same thing a few times. I mean, it's quite nice to see Yael Abbott get attacked, but other than that.
Yeah, this old woman. Maybe we're less keen to see her taken away, done away with. Push is a good comparison. And I was thinking specifically about Squeezing Tombs, you know, because we get this explanation, don't we? Again, Doggett quite good with the archival research because he's found this newspaper report from like 40 plus years ago about some kind of human bat attack. So just the fact that it's back and it's killing again after a prolonged interval, I think, is what reminds me of Tombs and, you know, Squeezing Tombs. But the thing is that Eugene Victor Toombs is kind of iconic. This creature, I don't think, is. No. Something like Squeeze gets a bit more mileage out of the premise in some ways. Like, it added in some interesting variations. Like, okay, let's bring Toombs in for questioning and things like that. Whereas in this episode, like I said, a bit of a sense that we're going through a cycle of killings that is just going to last until about the 40-minute mark. You know what I mean?
And, you know, like Toombs is a character, right? This man-bat is not a character. We don't know anything about it at all. I when I saw the actual design of the creature, my first thought was that it was a little bit like Rob Roberts, in Hungry, and I was like, well, if you had managed to combine the kind of like how Hungry makes you sympathize with Rob Roberts, if there had been like an element of that in this episode, then I feel like it would have been stronger. But like, yeah, we'll watch two episodes of Eugene Victor Toombs because he's an interesting character but it's always kind of creepy and exciting when he's on screen, whereas with the man bat, it's just like it's just another monster. Like, once you've seen like 150 episodes of the X-Files, it's like, okay, another one, I guess.
I suppose what's implicitly quite interesting is the fact that it appears the creature is like specifically targeting certain people and is after revenge.
Yeah,
you know, so presumably, I don't know what diet it's subsisting on, you know, like, apart from when he's killing these people. I'm assuming he's not after human flesh all the time, yeah? So that's kind of interesting, but never really comes to the, you know, it's kind of, like I say, it's kind of...
I think that they mention briefly about how it's an animal that kills with purpose, like the brute force and senses of an animal, but with, like, a human ability for, like the desire for revenge. And I think that's kind of like a you get that kind of premise in horror a lot, like Cujo or Jaws. And in fact, I think there's a bit towards the end that might be a Jaws reference, when Doggett disappears underwater and then you just get like a shot of the lake with the ripple across the top. That reminded me of that.
Yeah, that's a good catch. I didn't think of that actually, but yeah, you could well be right.
I just watched Jaws 2 days ago, so. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Of course, Quagmire is the classic Jaws X-Files connection, isn't it? With the guy who won't close the lake, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So the old woman is killed. There's another crime scene. That crime scene sequence has the interesting moment where Doggett takes the detective aside and like has a quiet word. And again, interesting that we're with Scully and don't hear what Doggett says, rather than being with Doggett and hearing what he says to kind of placate the guy. Again, that's very reminiscent of Silence of the Lambs for me, because I think Jack Crawford in that film does something similar when Clarice Starling is getting some resistance from local law enforcement. But in that film, he apologizes to Clarice, whereas Doggett, I don't think, does apologize to Scully here. So what do you think about that? Like, is he justified, Doggett, to be doing that?
Well, the thing is like, earlier in the episode, when Yael Abbott does that thing where he like steps between them and just faces Doggett, what I wanted Doggett to do was like move so that Yael Abbott had to look at like dog it, you have to use your male privilege. But now he's actually using it, and I'm like, is that a little bit disrespectful? I don't know. I mean, someone had to do something, right? But I feel for Scully, because I feel like this is coming at her twofold, because not only does she have Doggett and these other guys undermining her a little bit, she also seems to be lacking a lot of confidence, because she doesn't actually know what she's doing. She even says I'm not an expert, because she's trying to take on Mulder's role, but she doesn't fully know how to do that yet. And you know, so I feel bad for her, because she's not, you know, she's done this for so many years, but this is still not her element exactly. And she's like, she's trying to overcome this thing in her head of, oh, I have to be like Mulder. And at the same time, these people around her are like blocking her. So it's just, I really feel for her.
Yeah, no, I feel for her too. I think dramatically it works very well. I think, I'm not sure I could say Doggett's justified in doing that, but I can understand why he has done that. And I think in terms of the kind of man he is, you know, I think he works well with women. He's not going to be like a super feminist kind of guy, is he? So that's probably why he doesn't feel the need to kind of apologize or anything. I think it works dramatically because it helps to add to this sense of dislocation that Scully's going through, doesn't it? About this role that she's taking on. But in fact, they're both in quite uneasy positions, aren't they? Because there's this discussion about taking leaps. And like Doggett's like, well, that's how you get people killed, in my experience. And Scully's like, well, come on, you're believing in a human bat. That's kind of what she says.
I love that every X-Files broke with a leap. I'm like, well, yeah, that's how Mulder works, Doggett. That's all we know. And there was a bit earlier where they see like the claw marks on the ceiling. And he wants to say it looks like something was hanging there, but he actually can't get the words out. Because he's I can't say something like that.
Does nod, doesn't he? He does nod, doesn't he, when Scully voices that.
They're both kind of Doggett's experienced the X-Files literally for the first time. But Scully has never had to take on this particular role before. They're both learning as they go, I think.
Okay, so we have the crime scene stuff, and then I think this is about the point in the episode where we first see Ernie Stefaniak, but I don't think we know much about him or who he is yet, do we? It's all kind of mysterious.
And he's got something wrapped around his head, like the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
And this is where we see him. I don't know, is he like collecting bats or something? And then later on there's something about taxidermy. So I can only assume that he's killing them. Which is kind of sad. I used to get bats in my back garden. They're quite cool.
All right.
Just as a side note.
In what ways are they cool?
Well, it's the way they fly. It's like, because I would always see like a pair of them, and then they like circle round each other like that as they go. Yeah. It's quite weird. I'm living in London, and then there's just bats in my back garden. Like, okay.
Okay. So then, yeah, the moment that I think was, as much as a horrific murder can be called for, the detective here was kind of asking for it, wasn't he?
This is the, like, assholes never prosper in the X-Files. You can't come on screen and behave like that, expect to make it to the end of the episode. I mean, come on.
Yeah. What about the creature is not as scary as I remember it being. Like, I remember, maybe it's because I watched it in 2000 on like a much smaller TV and all that. And now I'm watching it on like a bigger TV and it's like HD quality. And I'm thinking maybe we see a bit too much of this creature. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe it comes back to the Jaws thing. It's scarier when you don't see it. Yeah, I don't find it. Yeah. I don't find this creature scary in the slightest. Like, the blood and stuff is gross, but no, I'm not frightened by it. And I don't know. I think I read somewhere that like the guy who played the creature had to be like super athletic. I think he was a swimmer or something like that, like a marathon runner, because he had to like dangle upside down for long periods at a time, which I find hysterical. But
yeah, that is funny.
But yeah, no, it's not. Again, it's a little bit camp, like
when you see it like leap through the air and stuff like that, and the fact that it's been waiting in that tree or whatever it was for the detective, it's like it knew exactly the right spot to hang out for him to come over, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I just remember it differently from actually watching it the first time. You know, I think, as I said, Roadrunners is next episode, and that that is much more eerie and icky, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, so the detective's out of the picture, but obviously he's got all these deputies or whoever they are. And at the morgue, one of the cops is like asking for a word with Doggett specifically, you know. I thought what was really interesting is like how quickly Scully becomes demonized. I think she actually uses the term lynch mob, doesn't she, when Doggett goes back in. But like all this stuff about she's responsible for this and we don't need her far out theories. Again, Mulder would have experienced some of this resistance, but probably not in quite so pointed a way that kind of is reminiscent of, like, you know, almost like she's been accused of being a witch or something. You know what I mean?
Right. That's a good comparison. And it is like, again, yes, thinking back to like Squeeze, Mulder experienced, he came up against bias, but it was always about what he believed and not who he was. It's just, and also it's not lost on me that this is happening in the season where Scully is pregnant, because, you know, women face extra prejudice in the workplace when they're pregnant, which is just something that occurred to me.
Yeah, well, even like this is interesting in the sense that within and without obviously explicitly refer to the pregnancy, it's much more implicit here, isn't it? Because there's the moment when she meets up with when she's with Ernie, and he says something about like, are you really going to sacrifice, you know, your family, your children, all this, and like there's a moment where her expression changes as she's thinking about that. But like this episode doesn't bring the pregnancy to the foreground, I guess, like the previous ones will and like some later ones will.
No, it doesn't. But I feel like it has to be in the back of your mind, especially like as it gets on, she's obviously quite visibly pregnant, and it's always like going to be an element to the season. But yeah.
Okay, so they track down this guy Myron, who's Ernie Stefaniak's brother, who's kind of like resistant, isn't he? He just wants to be left alone. And they go to kind of, I don't know if stakeout's the right word. They kind of tail him from a distance, don't they?
The car scene.
Yeah. Well, so what do you make of that then?
I like this scene a lot. Yeah. Well, most of it. And it's just like the way that Scully opens up to Doggett, or the way that even Doggett realizes that what's up with Scully and kind of like gets her to open up. And it's like she's trying to be like Mulder, not because she thinks that she's going to be a better investigator. She wants to be like Mulder because she misses him. And I think, you know, like I think we said earlier about how Scully's search for Mulder sort of replaces Mulder's search for Samantha. But I think many episodes of season 8 demonstrate that she's looking for Mulder, not in a literal physical sense, but she's searching for the spirit of Mulder, or the spirit of the believer that exists within her. I know that sounds kind of cringe, but that's what I think. I mean, even the fact that like the first two episodes of this season are called Within and Without, you know, I think that that there's a lot. She has a speech in a later episode about how Mulder would be so open-minded and she just wants to be like that. And it's just sad because she wants Mulder to be with her, so she's trying to find him like within her own self or something like that.
No, I think that's fascinating, and like in terms of this particular scene, it's strong stuff in my opinion. Like, and it's fascinating to watch her try and adopt this approach that was always quite intuitive for Mulder, wasn't it? And for her, it really isn't. It's like, well, and she realizes that when she's saying, like, I'm trying to manufacture a theory.
Yeah.
You know, which is like very different to the way Mulder thought. And I can understand why some people don't like season 8, because the thing is, in the early seasons, that dynamic between Mulder and Scully, those competing worldviews, that's a large part of why this is an iconic series, I think, you know, along with the fact that the actors are great and the storytelling is very strong, but it's the fact that you have that clash of belief systems. And I can understand why some people don't like it once that's removed. But I think seeing the series try to like rework itself with Mulder's perspective kind of absent is fascinating. And I think the issue is that the novelty of that, or the interest in that, doesn't last beyond the conclusion of the season 8 storyline, or maybe more specifically Mulder's return, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it works well here when they're kind of having to grapple with it.
Yeah. And something else about this scene is that Doggett gets the award for the dumbest line said in this episode. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Dude, who says that? Like, and it's so funny to me because it marks him so clearly as an outsider, because in the 1013 universe, that's not true in the slightest.
Wasn't there a book around this time that had that title or a similar title?
I wouldn't know because I wasn't alive, but
I was going to say, hang on, let me look this up. Men from Mars. There's a book by John Gray, 1992. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. It's a book written by an American author and relationship counselor. So what's this, 2000? So a relatively topical reference from Doggett, I suppose.
It couldn't, and Scully even rolls her eyes, because in this setting, he's just going to find out that that's not true at all. Like, Mulder is the least from Mars man you could possibly find.
I do like how Doggett has that kind of quite unadorned, kind of blunt way of speaking, though. You know, when he says things like "dollars to donuts," Agent Scully. Do you know what I mean? He's got quite a distinctive way of talking.
Yeah, that's like. True.
Yeah, we get okay. So Myron is the brother of Ernie. We meet up with Ernie, so we get the sense okay, he wouldn't leave the island for 44 years, knowing that this creature could come back to attack him, and that his wife has been with him. She was the woman who. The old woman we saw killed earlier was her mother, yeah?
Yeah.
And that this has all come to light because once the daughter died, the body had to go, she wanted to be buried on consecrated ground, and that somehow the bat creature found out, and this kicked off this series of events. Is that right? Is that how
yeah.
I understand that right?
I do feel like this is quite a tragic element to the episode, because this guy just wanted to do something nice for his dead wife, and he's inadvertently killed a bunch of people. Yeah. And imagining that, like you have to go and isolate yourself so that you don't die, and then your wife is like, "Yes, I'll give up everything to go with you." So that's quite sad.
What's quite sad is that he spent 44 years on this little island, when maybe he could have tried to go like further afield. And gotten away from this bat.
Because what Scully and Doggett now have the scent, and they are never hunted down for the rest of the show. So maybe if he'd have moved to like Washington DC, he would have been fine.
Yeah, maybe or gone overseas, because I don't know how far a bat can fly. Without,
well, that's true, because it's the island, right? Presumably, it's the water is protecting him, or some crap like that. So, like, yeah, I don't know. Go move to Hawaii, my guy.
Yeah, I don't know. He hasn't thought that through. I mean, he's had plenty of time to think about it. Okay, so it's interesting that, yeah, I think I mentioned this earlier, but it's interesting that Ernie is kind of interested in who figured it out. He's like asking Scully who figured it all out. It kind of it illuminates how I think the real interest here is more in Scully and Doggett than it is with... these guest characters.
I think that bit of dialogue is a bit on the nose, but I see what they're trying to say. although like there's another moment here where Doggett says, "Stay here, stay with him," and Dog goes out to find the man bat. It's like he's a few times it seems like he's trying to assert status over Scully, and he doesn't realize that he's doing it, that's the thing. But it's the same as when he like took Abbott aside. It's like he is the newbie, but he's trying to take charge of the situation, and I really don't think he's doing it on purpose, but it's still just a little bit frustrating. Like, he has no reason to doubt Scully or Scully's ability to go out and shoot a man bat, but he doesn't necessarily know that yet.
So what do you think about this? You know, we get the suspenseful scene of Scully looking for the creature and all of that. Doggett arrives, so she shoots it several times. Doggett arrives, shoots it too. But it seems like the creature's still out there. Is it an effective kind of end to this part of the episode?
I think the bit where the man bat almost kills Doggett made me think it would be so funny if the man bat had killed Doggett, and then every subsequent episode of season 8 was Scully getting a new partner who then gets killed off by the monster of the week, and then they're like, "This is hopeless," and then Mulder comes back and it's like, "Hurrah." That would have been quite funny. Then Ernie says something like, "The moment you set foot here, you're marked now," which I think could have been a comment about Doggett getting into the X-Files. Like, you're in the X-Files now, man. You've got a whole bunch of stuff coming your way. You have no idea. As for the ending, it's a little bit anticlimactic. And yeah, I mentioned earlier, I checked there is an entry about this in the X-Files archives by Paul Terry, which, like, if we take that to be canon, then supposedly in 2004, so 4 years later, Layla Harrison looks into this, because she's also like, oh, what happened to the man bat? Is it still alive? And then there's like a quote from someone who lives, from a resident in Burley, who's been hearing like screeching sounds along the river, and says it's definitely some kind of animal, but not like any animal I've heard before. So the implication is that the man bat is still out there.
Yeah. I'm glad you thought to look at that book, because I've read that book, but I completely forgot about the fact that it kind of introduces that element of adding a little bit to what we see in the episodes. So that's good to know, or well, maybe not good to know, depending on how you look at it. In terms of Doggett being a marked man, though, isn't the irony that he's like the only character from the X-Files that's managed to escape relatively unscathed? Because
true,
doesn't come back after season 9, doesn't return and become kind of doesn't go to the dark side like true. Reyes did.
But doesn't he technically die in like in 4D or whatever episode it is, like an alternate universe version of him dies or something like that? I don't know.
That's true. And also the gift where he kind of...
Yeah, that's... Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. So yeah. He went through... I also think it's really funny that, like, that in, like, Essence or something, there's, like the whole gang plus Krycek is in a room, and Doggett's like, you're really listening to this guy who tried to kill me? And I'm like, dude, almost getting killed by Krycek was simply your initiation into the X-Files. Like, yeah. Like, that's got to happen to everyone.
Okay, so finally then, so we pick it up 2 weeks later, I think, in the office. You get the sense, I think, that Doggett wouldn't be so quick to joke around with those guys again. Like, he mentions that there's some talk from the guys upstairs making noise about what's in our field report, and Scully's like, yeah, you get used to that. but you get kind of a sense that Doggett wouldn't be so off the cuff again, like he presumably was at the start of the episode, you know?
Yeah, I think he's learned his lesson. Or I hope so. But then he says, I'm pretty sure I hit it. I'm like, oh, you foolish boy. This is the X-Files. It's like, this happens like pretty consistently. Like at the end of Detour, you kind of get like the red eyes and glowing in the dark. And like, even, you know, Kitsune Nagari aside, even Pusher wasn't dead at the end of his episode. So it's always fairly open-ended, and you just gotta, I don't think you did hit it.
Yeah, you need to see a dead body, and even when you've seen a dead body, that isn't the end of the story.
That's not a guarantee, certainly not in this season.
Yeah. That's right. It's quite a nice scene, I think, so it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts. And like, what I like is, at the very end as well, when Scully puts Mulder's name badge away in the drawer, so
yes.
Returning us to that early scene, of course, but
yeah.
The fact that it's done very tentatively, I think, works well. So I appreciate the fact that they're quite cautious in these first two episodes with how they handle things and how they introduce Doggett.
I think that, like, it's supposed to be, it seems almost like an act of bravery on Scully's part that she puts that nameplate in the drawer, and she's just like, she's like deciding, right, I'm going to have to do this without Mulder, so I'm just going to get on with it.
Yeah.
And I will mention, because this is exciting to me, that if I remember rightly, the nameplate stays in that drawer and doesn't emerge again until Dead Alive, at which point it's Krycek, of all people, who puts it back on the desk.
Oh, really? Okay.
It is. That is an important detail to me.
I'd forgotten that, so I'm glad you reminded me.
Yeah, yeah, and he does it like, he gets out and he's like, oh, I heard he's still alive, and just like tosses it away, like onto the desk, like nonchalantly. But it's like, nonchalant or not, it's back on the desk, and Krycek put it there. Anyway. Yep. There's this, also this bit where Scully says, thank you for watching my back, which I think it's sweet of her to say thank you. I don't think Mulder and Scully ever said thank you to each other once. And then Doggett's like, well, I never saw it as an option. And that made me laugh, just because of the way that when Mulder goes to extremes to save Scully's life, you get some fans who are like, oh my God, it's because he loves her. Oh my God, MSR. And when Doggett does it, he's like, I'm an FBI agent. I have to. That's my job. Like, I'm her FBI partner. That's just how this works.
Yeah. And I think, like I was saying, I think I like the way they handle Doggett in these opening episodes. And I think some people, especially at the time, I think some people felt that we were expected as the viewers to like him too quickly. And I don't agree. I think they do it really cleverly in Within, how they introduce him. And I think in this instance, it's not like he's being shoved down our throats. It's like, it's very clear here that Mulder hasn't been forgotten about. It's not like they've solved the case like really easily in his absence, is it? Like their investigation has ended on this quite uneasy, unresolved note in the tradition of lots of earlier episodes. So I think it's handled quite deftly, actually.
Yeah, I agree that Mulder's never forgotten about. Like his ghost, whether literally or metaphorically, is always kind of present. And both of them are kind of trying to live up to it in one way or another. But yeah, I think that we're supposed to experience this as Scully experiences it, where Doggett will grow on us slowly as we learn to realise that he's just doing his best and it's not his fault, he's not Mulder.
Okay, so Christopher, any final thoughts on Patience, or should we head into the X-Cast mailbag? What do you reckon?
I think we should head into the mailbag.
Yeah, let's do that right now then. We'll start with Tony Black, who says, a really fine mission statement for the semi-rebooted nature of the show's concept. There probably hasn't been this stripped back to basics of story since the early days, and in many ways the simplicity of it and how awkwardly Scully has to try and adopt Mulder's mantle is crucial. Mulder would probably have all this solved in 5 minutes, whereas Scully and Doggett have to work at it more. That's not a criticism of the episode. In fact, I think it's a boon. It allows Patience to be dark and creepy while also remaining uncomplicated. Very good monster of the week. And he says, P.S. Gene Dinarski, who plays the reclusive Ernie Stefaniak, is very memorable as the bloke Dennis Weaver's terrified car driver in Steven Spielberg's Duel picks a fight over while he's eating a sandwich. That and Patience are the two things I know him from.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I've seen Duel a couple of times, but I can't picture this actor in that film.
Seen that film? I haven't, but I feel like I've only ever heard it when Tony talks about it. And I feel like him bringing up Jewel in this comment is like me bringing up Krycek at every opportunity.
You know, it kind of is. So it was a Spielberg film that it was made as a TV movie, but then it got some cinematic distribution and it was very good. It's about a man who gets chased by a truck. And it's good. I mean, Tony, it's not as good as things like Jaws, I'm going to say, but it's good. I agree. Right. What about, so he's talking about how it's like, yeah, this dark and creepy episode, and it's also uncomplicated. And I kind of agree whilst thinking that there are still some weak aspects like we kind of discussed.
Well, maybe he's suggesting that the simplicity of the case is a feature rather than a bug. Because it allows for that thing that he mentioned of Mulder would have solved this in 5 minutes and Scully and Doggett have to work a little bit harder, and that is important to showing their characters and their dynamic. So yeah, that's an interesting point.
Okay, so Liam Coughlin says, it's waited 44 years, it'll wait as long as it takes. And he says, glorious. Unlike a lot of the episodes in the two seasons previously, this hour has gotten better with age, now feeling like the entire series in microcosm. Threads that will run through the season, the passing of years, the guilt of sins of yore, the creeping inevitability of fate, all resonate richly in a script that fires on all cylinders. A re-energized Carter returns to the series' roots, delivering a spectacular scarefest that harkens back to the show's original debt to The Night Stalker and The Twilight Zone. The new dynamic is established deftly with some wonderful callbacks to the dynamism of yore, except this time it's Scully who is at the helm of the projector in the basement, etc. Mulder has been effectively retooled to become a Campbellian archetype and a mission statement for the series. In an odd way, he is now Scully's Samantha, a standout from a fine season. So I really like this comment, whilst at the same time, I felt the opposite, that it hasn't got better with age. I feel like I can see the issues with it more clearly now than I could like 20 years ago. What do you think of that comment?
I think, yeah, the Campbellian shout is a good one. I think that also, this person has touched on something that we kind of glanced over about the waiting 44 years and could you give all this stuff up? And that's kind of a theme that perhaps it came, I remember it coming up a lot in season 6, like how much are you willing to give up? And then it comes back in existence. Doggett says something to Mulder about how long until the next monster rears its head. And that's kind of, I don't know, the kind of, the X-Files reflecting on itself and kind of the consequences of the Xbox having gone on this long in both a internal and external sense. So yeah, that's like, I think that's like quite quintessentially Chris Carter to have a line like that in the episode.
Okay, so Ana Brigida Gomez says, "One thing I don't like about this episode is the promise of continuation that never was revisited. The show tended to do that a lot, and it became annoying because they do revisit some villains once in a while. So you hope they will do it, but then it never happens with the ones you expect them to." So I suppose it reminds me of something like Shapes, where, like, you know, at the end of the episode, you get something like, "We'll see you in 8 years." And actually, about season eight, about this time, we should be seeing the sequel to Shapes, shouldn't we? I never expected them to revisit Patience. You just kind of take it as par for the course with a lot of these creatures, don't you? They have to get to a certain level of iconicity to be kind of sequel candidates. And I'm not sure Patience kind of does that, does it?
No, I don't think so. And again, this, I think it happens. It's just almost like part of the formula of a monster of the week that you get that ambiguous ending, like that the evil is still out there. And it's, but yeah, it's not like if you think about the villains who did come back, what, Tombs Pusher and Donnie Faster. And it's like, I think that there's clearly a specific type of villain there, that they're human beings for the most part. And that they're like actual characters who have lines and stuff like that. That makes more sense. I think that I don't particularly think I would have expected or wanted a Patience sequel, but yeah.
No, I mean, if it was going to happen, maybe it would be better in the comics or something, because like, I think it's in the comics that they reintroduce like the Fluke Man, and maybe get a bit more mileage out of the non-humanoid kind of sort of, yeah, he's kind of half human, I suppose. But
yeah, and or maybe like because of this this kind of theme of waiting and time passing, maybe the revival even. But even then, I wasn't like desperate to see the man bat return.
Okay, so we'll just do two more comments. So Andrew Levitt says, "A Back to Basics episode sets up the dynamic between Scully and Doggett for the seasons to come. There are obvious throwbacks to early episodes, such as Squeeze and Shadows, with links to troubled events in the past of the small community creating issues in the present. Yet the episode puts its original spin on these concepts with an intriguing and creepy man-bat concept. Scully's struggle to act as the believer makes a journey towards this perspective all the more believable, and it's refreshing to see she's not thrust straight into Mulder's role without some internal conflict and resistance from Doggett. Another solid 8 out of 10 episode." Yeah, I mean, I agree with what he says at the end there. Like, if Scully had slotted straight into quote-unquote Mulder's role without struggling a bit with it, I think it would have been a big mistake, you know? So I think it is good that they handle it the way they did in early season 8. Finally, then, Heather Bain says, "I used to dislike this episode very much. The monster is dumb. The local law enforcement are jerks, and I just didn't see a point to it as a whole. Then about 5 rewatches ago, something changed. I got the point of the episode, and now I like it as an introduction to the new Scully-Doggett dynamic. The monster's still dumb, but it is effectively gross and the killings are scary. Doggett and Scully both do a lot of catching up with themselves and each other in this episode. He's off to a rough start at the beginning, but by the end, he seems to be getting it a bit more. I like the interaction between them in the car when Doggett tells Scully that even if they don't exactly agree, he doesn't think she's wrong. The episode is literally darker than the last 2 seasons too, which helps with the whole feel of the show." Yeah, Christopher, anything to add to either of those last couple of comments?
Yeah, I can imagine like that the kind of the detectives being horrible. Like, you can see why that might have put some people off watching the episode, but again, like, once you see what seems to be the point, then it works quite well.
All right, so Christopher, let me know where I can find you online, or where, by extension, other people can find you online. What are you up to on social media and that kind of thing?
So I'm on Twitter at chpillbeam. I tweet almost exclusively about the X-Files. So, and I write for 25 Years Later, the website, and May is X-Files month. So there'll be lots of X-Files articles from me and other writers.
Yeah, so now, interestingly, that's going to be, you know, by the time this episode actually goes out, that's going to be very close, I think, X-Files Month.
Right,
so is that going to be new articles, what, like every day or just regularly, or how is that going to work out?
I can't remember the schedule, but I know that I have four articles in the works for X-Files Month, so that works out to one a week.
It's great, isn't it, that people are still writing about, thinking about, watching the X-Files, even, what, almost 30 years since it began.
Yeah.
So long may it continue. all right, so I'm on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. I'm also in the X-Cast basement on Facebook. The X-Cast you can find on Twitter at @X_cast. You can also find us, like I say, on Facebook. We've got a page there and a group, and we're also on Instagram. But that's it for this episode, listeners. My thanks to Christopher for joining me. But until next time, always remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. We dig music.
I got given a set of mindfulness cards as a Christmas present.
Okay.
And it's a load of fucking bollocks, it really is.
Is it like, with them being cards, I've got them, like, this image of them being like Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies, but with, like, go and read a book or something like that.
Yeah, pretty much. these cards, you read them one a day and you're meant to do the tasks. And the task on one day was...
Listen to Bruce Springsteen.
Go and listen to a piece of music that you haven't heard before and listen to it without any prejudice, regardless of genre. And I'm like, have you met me? That isn't possible.
I do that every day anyway.
So I went and listened to something I hadn't heard before and didn't know what genre it was going to be because it was from a set of polls on Twitter. And I listened to this song. It was about someone, an obsessive thought and worrying they were going to start cutting themselves. And I'm thinking, well, this isn't very mindful.
Chucky Vision. A Chucky podcast.
I'm vaguely familiar with Point Horror.
Did you ever read any?
Maybe as a kid, but I don't know them as well as I do Goosebumps.
Right, okay. But how do you feel the kind of adaptation from the books to the series worked? Were they direct adaptations of the books, or were they more inspired by continuation of?
They were pretty direct, actually. There's like 60 books or so, or at least in the original run. He always did those like Goosebumps 2000 and stuff. Like, he was always updating the titles, which, I mean, God knows what kids are reading these days. I don't know if they're reading the original books.
Gotham U, a Batman podcast.
Hear what you're saying, and I can't help but think, like, is it just nostalgia that's giving Michael Keaton the pass on this? But also, it's not his fault. Warner Brothers came and gave him a check and was like, hey, be Batman. What's he gonna do, say no?
No, not at all. And Michael Keaton himself even loved being Batman. He did an interview not too long ago. I don't remember what the interview was, but he was talking about coming back. And he described why he didn't do Batman Forever. And, you know, for years there have been speculations, there have been rumors, and he put it to rest. And what everyone said was true. He just didn't like the direction that Warner Brothers was going with the Bat franchise.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at We Made This Pod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.